This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm coming to you again today from our friends up in Boston at partner station WGBH. Boston, which was the setting for a remarkable film, Mystic River, you may remember, back in 2003. It was all about how a horrible case of police sexual abuse destroyed lives and almost derailed a murder investigation. Sean Penn was in the movie, Kevin Bacon, Tim Robbins. We begin this hour looking at a three-part real-life investigation of police misconduct being reported this week by the Associated Press that shows a nationwide pattern of police sexual misconduct. Approximately 1,000 officers across 41 states examined have had their badges stripped during a period from 2009 to 2014 for offenses like rape, sexual assault, and other crimes. But it's just the smallest window on a problem that points up how suspects can become victims and officers violent perpetrators, a victimization that parallels the police brutality cases of Eric Garner, killed in July of last year, the case of Michael Brown, who died in Ferguson, Missouri, and the deaths of Walter Scott and Freddie Gray in 2015. How this sexual abuse happens and is kept hidden within a closed culture of law enforcement that varies widely across the nation is the result of work by Noman Merchant, Associated Press reporter who led the investigation alongside Matt Sadensky. Noman joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What kinds of cases did you look at that seem to suggest that there is a culture of nondisclosure here, which may be much more widespread than we've thought up until now?
We found a number of cases in which an officer had been accused of sexual assault in one police department or sexual misconduct in one department, and through a variety of different ways or oversights moved to another department. We found a case out of Grand Junction, Colorado, where a police officer had been accused of sexual assault at his previous employer, but that accusation didn't come forward until he had already been hired by another department. And he eventually ended up being accused of sexual assault at that second employer, and that's when previous allegations came to light. He eventually was accused of three allegations and ended up committing suicide. And that was just one example of what police chiefs I interviewed talked about as this culture of nondisclosure. In the case of that Colorado officer, the police chief in Grand Junction, Colorado, told me that he has started to ask all officers applying to his department to allow any sort of disclosure from their previous employers, any material, any paperwork, to be provided to his hiring department. And if they refuse to do that, that's a major red flag and they won't consider them for employment any longer. So this is something that police chiefs both acknowledge and are trying to fix.
Noman, I remember the reporting and did a bunch of it myself of the problems within the Catholic Church and the Vatican response and the church hierarchical response. And in that particular instance, there was this tension over handling it internally versus reporting it out and having law enforcement deal with it. It sounds like some of the internal, external, non-disclosure issues are eerily similar to what went on within the Catholic Church. Would you say that's the case?
I would say, speaking specifically to law enforcement, like any major institution, there's a certain amount of we can take care of our own. But I think, by and large, one major difference is that it's so decentralized in the United States. Local and state law enforcement agencies have a lot of autonomy and don't really respond in great detail to a federal agency when it comes to police misconduct or reporting data. And so that sort of thing happens at a local level, and it's sort of a case-by-case basis. I think it's tough to make a broad statement.
How would you say the power relationship of police officers makes them more inclined or makes victims more vulnerable to misconduct of this kind? Any commentary on that? Any suggestion that this is a dangerous situation to begin with sometimes?
This is something that the International Association of Chiefs of Police actually identified in a 2011 report, where they talked about the culture of law enforcement potentially being a place where a predator could operate. You know, officers, according to this report, operate without a lot of immediate close supervision. They operate, in many cases, at night in communities where there are a lot of people who've had contacts with law enforcement before, and their stories may not necessarily be believed. A lot of the victims in these cases that we found have had contact with law enforcement before. They have arrests on their records. They have convictions. Some of them struggle with drug addiction before, during, and after an alleged attack. And in many cases, these are the people that law enforcement and sort of society's institutions of safeguard are there to protect. And that didn't happen in a lot of their cases.
So you're describing transactions, and I use that word so guardedly, like an officer who says, one more strike and you're going up the river, and if you want to prevent that, do A, B, or C, or I can call somebody and have you deported tomorrow kind of thing. Are these the scenarios that you find in your reporting?
Yeah, there are a lot of instances of officers who pulled over somebody in a traffic stop, and whether or not there was some sort of illegal activity, a DUI potentially or something like that, an officer might have said, do this or you're going to jail. And I think one of the other things that's worth keeping in mind is there were a number of cases in prisons and jails where prison guards and sheriff's deputies protecting jails would say to an inmate, do this or there's going to be some sort of punishment. And really, an inmate is not really in a position to consent to that type of activity.
This 1,000 number that you talked about, in 41 states, 1,000 officers had their badges stripped from 2009 to 2014. This is really perhaps the biggest headline here. That number might seem small, but really it's because of the pattern of state-to-state approaches to this that vary very radically across the nation. Can you describe how that works or doesn't?
Yeah. Decertification is, in many cases, sort of a last resort. In many cases, you need to have been convicted of a crime to face a decertification. And we found that states vary greatly on how they decertify officers or when they decertify officers. Some states that have more than 1,000 officers decertified for all types of misconduct over a six-year period don't necessarily have worse officers than a state that didn't decertify anybody. It's just a matter of how active police departments and sheriff's offices are in reporting misconduct, and state agencies are in taking action on that misconduct. We found that there were six states that don't decertify for misconduct. They include some of the biggest states in the United States. And we also found that among the states that do decertify, some just didn't give us records, and some gave us very few records or didn't give us a lot of material to work with to research why they had decertified these officers.
Finally, these are crimes. If officers commit crimes, it would seem like it would be relatively simple to convict them of crimes. And in that case, they're not officers. They're off the street. You found that's not the case at all?
Well, I'd say there's a couple of things to that. The first thing is that there are things that an officer can do in the realm of misconduct that don't necessarily lead to a criminal charge for whatever reason. The other thing is that for many reasons that advocates for sexual assault victims can talk about more eloquently, you know, an allegation may not lead to a prosecution.
Noman Merchant is Associated Press reporter who led this investigation of law enforcement around the United States alongside his colleague, Matt Sedensky. Noman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A police voice now on this issue. Norm Stamper was Seattle's police chief from 1994 to 2000. Norm Stamper, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
So how familiar is something like this to you in your experience? We should point out that you're the author of a book, Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. Does this sound familiar to you?
It sounds depressingly familiar. One chapter in that book is entitled Sexual Predators in Uniform. And it's safe to say that no jurisdiction anywhere in this country, police jurisdiction, has been free of this kind of history.
How are officers who listen to this segment, if they do, how are they going to react to this? Oh, here we go again. The media is trashing the police and you know, exaggerating something that's not as big of a problem as the media thinks it is.
Well, that reaction is to be expected. It would also be an unfortunate reaction. This kind of exposure, I think, is critical to the kinds of reforms that are necessary in law enforcement. One of the biggest problems associated with sexual predators in uniform is a lack of supervision, a lack of peer pressure.
Can you comment on the notion that the power position of officers creates a vulnerability and the culture of non-disclosure is a real obstacle of dealing with this? And how did that affect you dealing with this in your own department?
Well, both of those issues are relevant. Both of those issues are terribly important. If there is an attitude bred by the culture that nobody from the outside can really understand the pressures, the organizational and occupational pressures that are associated with police work today. But in point of fact, there are 18,000 police departments in this country, and each and every one of them is different from all the others. But they all have one thing in common, and that is that there are temptations that exist in police work. There are tendencies among the population of police officers that are very discernible and are very predictable, and that makes it much easier for us to deal with this issue.
How did you handle it?
By insisting as a non-negotiable expectation that if you want to be a police officer in this city, whatever city that might happen to be, I was a police officer in San Diego for 28 years, left there as the number two guy. And in both those agencies, San Diego and Seattle, with some degree of regularity, we dealt with an individual officer accused of sexual violence on the job. And we took the view that if you want to be a police officer in this city, you absolutely will not engage in any kind of dating behavior, any kind of overtures toward the men or women you stop on the job. And you had better recognize that if you attempt to trade freedom for sexual gratification, you're out of here. You're toast.
Do you support a uniform or more aggressive reporting and decertification procedures around the United States to create more uniformity?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that needs to happen. Certification, I think, needs to be a national proposition so that nobody can go from one department to another and engage in the same behavior that may have gotten him fired in that previous organization.
Norm Stamper is the former Seattle police chief from 94 to 2000, author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing, and a forthcoming book on fixing issues within the police force. He joined us from Orcas Island off Washington State. Norm Stamper, thanks for talking with us from paradise there.
My pleasure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.